main drift of the dialect of Arawak being spoken by the particular tribe he was observing.
"It's a mountain village," he explained, as soon as he saw that she was watching. "Much more temperate than the villages near the coast. A different kind of agriculture."
"And the occasion?" she asked.
"I'm seeing the lives that were interrupted by the Spanish," he said. "This is only a few weeks before an expedition finally comes up the mountain to take them into slavery. The Spanish are getting desperate for labor down on the coast."
"The plantations are growing?"
"Not at all," said Hassan. "In fact, they're failing. But the Spanish aren't very good at keeping their Indi slaves alive."
"Do they even try?"
"Most do. The murder for sport attitude is here, of course, because the Spanish have absolute power, and for some that power has to be tested to the limit. But by and large, the priests have got control of things, and they're really trying to keep the slaves from dying."
"Priests in control," thought Tagiri, "and yet slavery is unchallenged."
But even though it always tasted freshly bitter in her mouth, she knew that there was no point in reminding Hassan of the irony of it. Wasn't he on the slavery project with her? "The people of Anquash are perfectly aware of what's going on. They've already figured out that they're just about the last Indies left who haven't been enslaved. They've tried to stay out of sight, lighting no fires, and making sure the Spanish don't see them. But there are too many Arawaks and Caribs of the lowlands who are saving some bit of their freedom by collaborating with the Spanish. They remember Anquash. So there'll be an expedition soon, and they know it. You see?"
What Tagiri saw was an old man and a middle-aged woman, squatting on opposite sides of a small fire, where a jar of water was giving off steam. She smiled at the new technology. To be able to see steam in the holographic display was amazing. She almost expected to be able to smell it.
"Tobacco water," said Hassan.
"They drink the nicotine solution?"
Hassan nodded. "I've seen this sort of thing before."
"Aren't they being careless? This doesn't look like a smokeless fire."
"The true sight may be enhancing the smoke too much in the hollow, so there may be less of it than we're seeing," said Hassan. "But smoke or not, there's no way to boil the tobacco water without fire, and at this point, they're near despair. Better to risk their smoke being seen than to go another day without word from the gods."
"So they drink."
"They drink and dream," said Hassan.
"Don't they give greater trust to dreams that come of themselves?" asked Tagiri.
"They know that most dreams mean nothing. They hope that their nightmares mean nothing. Fear dreams instead of true dreams. They use the tobacco water to make the gods tell them the truth. Farther down the slopes, the Arawaks and Caribs would have offered a human sacrifice, or bled themselves the way the Mayas do. But this village has no tradition of sacrifice, and never adopted it from their neighbors. They're a holdout from a different tradition, I think. Similar to some tribes in the upper Amazon. They don't need death or blood to talk to the gods."
The man and the woman both tipped pipes into the water and then sucked liquid up into their mouths as if through a drinking straw. The woman gagged. The man was apparently inured to the liquid. The woman began to look very sick, but the man made her drink more.
"The woman is Putukam. The name means wild dog," said Hassan. "She's a woman noted for her visions, but she hasn't used tobacco water much before."
"I can see why not," said Tagiri.
For now the woman named Putukam was puking and retching.
For a moment or two, the old man tried to steady her, but in moments he too was vomiting. Their discharge mingled and flowed into the ashes of the fire. On the other hand, Baiku is a healer,
so he uses the drugs more. All the time, actually. So he can send his spirit into the body of the sick person and find out what's wrong. Tobacco water is his favorite. Of course, it still makes him vomit. It makes everybody vomit. Making him a candidate for stomach cancer. He should live so long, said Hassan. Do the gods speak to them? Hassan shrugged. Let's zip ahead and see. He rushed the display for a few moments. Putukam and Baiku may have slept for hours, but to the past watchers it took only seconds. Whenever they stirred, the true sight automatically slowed down a little. Only when it was clear that the movements were signs of waking, not the normal wriggling of sleep, did Hassan bring the speed back to normal. Now he turned up the sound, and because Tagiri was there, he used the computer translator instead of just listening to the native speech sounds. I dreamed, said Putukam. And I, said Baiku. Let me hear the healing dream, said Putukam. There is no healing in it, he said, his face looking grave and sad. All slaves? All except the blessed ones, who are murdered or die from plagues. And then? All dead. This is our healing, then, said Putukam. To die. Better to have been captured by Caribs. Better to have our hearts torn out and our livers eaten. Then at least we would be an offering to a god. What was your dream? My dream was madness, she said. My dream had no truth in it. The dreamer does not know, said Baiku. She sighed. You will think I am a poor dreamer indeed, and the gods hate my soul. I dreamed of a man and woman watching us. They were full grown, and yet I knew in the dream that they are 40 generations younger than us. Tagiri interrupted. Stop, she said. He stopped. Was that translation correct? She demanded. Hassan spun the true sight back a little and ran the scene again, this time with the translator routine suppressed. He listened to the native speech twice. The translation is right enough, he said. The words she used that were rendered as man and woman are from an older language, and I think there may be overtones that might make the words mean hero man and hero woman. Less than gods, but more than human. But they often use those words for talking about each other, as opposed to people from other tribes. Hassan, she said, I'm not asking about etymology. I'm asking about the meaning of what she said. He looked at her blankly. Don't you think that it sounded very much as though she were seeing us? But that's absurd, said Hassan. 40 generations. Isn't the time about right? A man and a woman watching? Out of all possible dreams, can't there be dreams of the future? Asked Hassan. And since Past Watch scours all eras of history so thoroughly now, isn't it likely that eventually a watcher will witness the telling of a dream that seems to be a dream of the watcher himself? Probability of coincidence, she said. She knew that principle, of course. It had been thoroughly covered in the later stages of training. But there was something else. Yes. As Hassan showed the scene yet a third time, it seemed to Tagiri that when Putukam spoke of her dream, her gaze was steady in the direction from which Hassan and Tagiri were watching. Her eyes focused as if she could actually see them, or some glimmer of them. It can be disorienting, can't it? Hassan grinned at her. Show the rest, said Tagiri. Of course it was disorienting, but scarcely less so than Hassan's grin. None of her other subordinates would ever have grinned at her like that, with such a personal comment. Not that Hassan was being impertinent. Rather, he was simply friendly. Yes, that was it. He started the true sight viewing beyond what they had seen before. I dreamed that they watched me 3 times, Putakam was saying, and the woman seemed to know that I could see her. Hassan slammed his hand onto the pause button. There is no God but God, he muttered in Arabic, and Muhammad is his prophet. Tagiri knew that sometimes when a Muslim says this, it is because he has too much respect to curse the way a Christian might. Probability of coincidence, she murmured. I was just thinking that it seemed as though she could see us. If I go back and we watch the scene again, said Hassan, then it will be 4 times, not 3. But it had been 3 times when we first heard her say how many. That will never change. The true sight has no effect on the past, said Hassan. It can't possibly be detected there. And how do we know that? Asked Tagiri. Because it's impossible. In theory. And because it never has. Till now. You want to believe that she really saw us in her nicotine dream? Tagiri shrugged, feigning a nonchalance she didn't feel. If she saw us, Hassan, then let's go on and see what it means to her. Hassan slowly, almost timidly, released the true sight to continue exploring the scene. This is prophecy, then, Baiku was saying. Who knows what wonders the gods will bring in 40 generations? I always thought that time moved in great circles, as if all of us had been woven into the same great basket of life, each generation another ring around the rim, said Putakam. But when, in the great circles of time, was there ever such horror as these white monsters from the sea? So the basket is torn, and time is broken, and all the world spills out of the basket into the dirt. What of the man and woman who watch us? Nothing, said Putakam. They watched us. They were interested. They see us now? They saw all the suffering in your dream, said Putakam. They were interested in it. What do you mean, interested? I think they were sad, said Putakam. But were they white then? Did they watch the people suffer and care nothing for it, like the white men? They were dark. The woman is very black. I have never seen a person of such blackness of skin. Then why don't they stop the white men from making us slaves? Maybe they can't, said Putakam. If they can't save us, said Baiku, then why do they look at us, unless they are monsters who enjoy the suffering of others? Turn it off, said Tagiri to Hassan. He paused the display again and looked at her in surprise. He saw something in her face that made him reach out and touch her arm. Tagiri, he said gently. Of all people who have ever watched the past, you are the one who has never, even for a moment, forgotten compassion. She has to understand, murmured Tagiri. I would help her if I could. How can she understand such a thing? Asked Hassan. Even if she really saw us somehow, in a true dream, she can't possibly comprehend the limitations on what we can do. To her, the ability to see into the past like this would be the power of the gods. So of course she will think we can do anything, and simply choose not to. But you know and I know that we can't, and therefore choose not at all. The vision of the gods, without the power of the gods,
said Tagiri. What a terrible gift.
A glorious gift, said Hassan. You know that the stories we've brought out of the slavery project have awakened great interest and compassion in the world around us. You can't change the past, but you've changed the present, and these people are no longer forgotten. They loom larger in the hearts of the people of our time than the old heroes ever did. You have given these people the only help that it was in your power to give. They're no longer forgotten. Their suffering is seen.
It isn't enough, said Tagiri.
If it's all that you can do, said Hassan, then it is enough.
I'm ready now, said Tagiri. You can show the rest of it.
Perhaps we should wait. She reached down and pressed the button to resume the display. Putukam and Baiku gathered the dirt where their vomit had formed mud. They threw it into the tobacco water. The fire under it had died, so no steam was rising. Yet they put their faces over the water as if to smell the steam of the dirt and the vomit and the tobacco. Putukam began a chant. From my body, from the earth, from the spirit water, I... The Trusak, too, paused automatically. It can't translate the word, said Hassan. And neither can I. It's not in the normally used vocabulary. They do use scraps of older languages in their magicking, and this may be related to a root in the old language that means shaping, like forming something out of mud. So she's saying, I shape you, or something related to that.
Go on, said Tagiri.
Putukam's chant began again. From my body, from the earth, from the spirit water, I shape you, O children of 40 generations, who look at me from inside my dream. You see the suffering of us and all the other villages. You see the white monsters who make us slaves and murder us. You see how the gods send plagues to save the blessed ones and leave only the cursed ones to bear this terrible punishment. Speak to the gods, O children of 40 generations, who look at me from inside my dream. Teach them mercy. Let them send a plague to take us all and leave the land empty for the white monsters. So they will hunt and hunt for us from shore to shore and find none of us, no people at all, not even the human-eating Caribs. Let the land be empty, except for our dead bodies, so that we will die in honor as free people. Speak to the gods for us, O man, O woman. And so it went on like that, Baiku taking over the chant when Putukam wearied. Soon others from the village gathered around them and sporadically joined in the chant, especially when they were intoning the name they were praying to. Children of 40 generations who look at us from inside the dream of Putukam. They were still chanting when the Spanish, led by two shame-faced Indi guides, shambled along the path, their muskets, pikes, and swords at the ready. The people made no resistance. They kept up the chant, even after they had all been seized, even as the old men, including Baiku, were being gutted with swords or spitted on pikes. Even as the young girls were being raped, all who could speak kept up the chanting, the prayer, the conjuration, until finally the Spanish commander, unnerved by it all, walked over to Putukam and drove his sword into the base of her throat, just above where the collarbones come together. With a gurgle, she died,
and the chanting ended. For her, as for Baiku, the prayer was answered. She was not a slave before she died. With all the villagers dead, Tagiri reached down again, but Hassan's hand was there before her, stopping the display. Tagiri was trembling, but she pretended not to feel strong emotions. "I have seen such terrible things before," said Tagiri. "But this time, she saw me. Saw us.
Or so it seems."
"She saw Hassan."
"So it seems."
Now the words admitted she might be right. Something from our time, from right now, was visible to her in her dream. Perhaps we were still visible when she awoke. It seemed to me that she was looking at us. I didn't think of her seeing us until after she awoke from her dream. And yet she saw that I knew she could see us. It's too much to be chance.
"If this is true," said Hassan, "then why haven't other watchers using the true sight too been seen? Perhaps we're only visible to those who need so desperately to see us."
"It's impossible," said Hassan. "We were taught that from the beginning."
"No," said Tagiri.
"Remember the course in the history of Past Watch? The theorists weren't certain, were they? Only years of observation convinced them that their theory was right. But in the early days, there was much talk of temporal backwash."
"So you paid more attention in class than I did," said Hassan.
"Temporal backwash," she said again. "Don't you see how dangerous this is?"
"If it's true, if they really saw us, then it can't be dangerous because, after all, nothing changed as a result of it."
"Nothing would ever seem to change," she said, "because we would then live in the version of the present created by the new past. Who knows how many changes, small and great, we might have made, and yet never knew it because the change made our present different and we couldn't remember it being any other way."
"We can't have changed anything at all," said Hassan, "or history would have changed. And even if Past Watch itself still existed, certainly the circumstances where we decided to stand here together and watch this village would never have happened in just that way. And therefore the change we made in the past would have unmade our very making of that change, and therefore it couldn't happen. She didn't see us."
"I know the circularity argument as well as you do, Hassan," she said. "But this particular case proves it false. You can't deny that she saw us, Hassan. You can't call it coincidence. Not when she saw I was black."
He grinned. "If the devils of her time are white, then maybe she needed to invent a god as black as you.
She also saw that there were two of us. That we watched her three times. That I knew she could see us. She even got our era approximately right. She saw and she understood. We changed the past." Hassan shrugged.
"I know," he said.
Then he sat up, alert again, having found an argument. "It doesn't mean that circularity is proved false," he said. "The Spaniards behaved exactly as they would have anyway. So any change that came about because she saw us watching her made no difference in the future, because she and all her people were so soon dead. Maybe that's the only time the true sight too has a backwash effect, when it can't possibly make a difference. So the past is still safe from our meddling. Which means we're also safe." Tagiri did not bother pointing out that even though the Spaniards had killed or enslaved everyone, it didn't change the fact that because of what Putukam saw in her vision, the people were chanting a prayer as they were taken. That had to have an effect on the Spaniards. It had to bend their lives, just a little bit,
the sheer strangeness of it. No change in the past would fail to have some kind of reverberation. It was the butterfly's wing, just as they taught in school. Who knew whether or not a storm in the North Atlantic might not have been triggered far back in the chain of cause and effect by the flapping of a butterfly's wing in China? But there was no point in arguing this with Hassan. Let him believe in safety while he could. Nothing was safe now. But neither were the watchers powerless, either. "She saw me," said Tagiri. "Her desperation made her believe I was a god, and her suffering makes me wish that she were right. To have the power to help these people. Hassan, if she could sense us, it means that we're sending something back. And if we're sending anything back at all, anything, then perhaps we could do something that would help." "How could we save that village?" said Hassan. "Even if it were possible to travel back in time, what would we do? Lead an avenging army to destroy the Spanish who came to take this village? What would that accomplish? More Spanish would come later, or English, or some other conquering nation from Europe. And in the meantime, our own time would have been destroyed, undone by our own intervention. You can't change great sweeps of history by changing one small event. The forces of history go on anyway." "Dear Hassan," she said, "you tell me now that history is such an inexorable force that we can't alter its onward march. Yet a moment ago you told me that any change, however small, would alter history by so much that it would undo our own time. Explain to me why this isn't a contradiction."
"It is a contradiction, but that doesn't mean it's untrue. History is a chaotic system. The details can shift endlessly, but the overall shape remains constant. Make a small change in the past, and it changes enough details in the present that we would not have come together at exactly this place and time to watch exactly this scene. And yet the great movements of history would be largely unchanged."
"Neither of us is a mathematician," said Tagiri. "We're just playing logic games. The fact is that Putukam saw us, you and me. There is some kind of sending from our time to the past. This changes everything. And soon the mathematicians will discover truer explanations for the workings of our time machines, and then we'll see what's possible and what isn't. And if it turns out that we can reach into the past, deliberately and purposefully, then we will do it, you and I."
"And why is that?"
"Because we're the ones she saw. Because she shaped us.
She prayed for us to send a plague to wipe out all the Indies before the Europeans ever came. Are you really going to take that seriously?"
"If we're going to be gods," said Tagiri, "then I think we have a duty to come up with better solutions than the people who pray to us."
"But we're not going to be gods," said Hassan.
"You seem sure of that," she said.
"Because I'm quite sure the people of our time won't relish the idea of our world being undone in order to ameliorate the suffering of one small group of people so long dead."
"Not undone," said Tagiri. "Remade."
"You're even crazier than a Christian," said Hassan. "They believe that one man's death and suffering was worth it because it saved all of humankind. But you... you're ready to sacrifice half the people who ever lived just to save one village."
She glared at him. "You're right," she said. "For one village, it wouldn't be worth it." She walked away. It was real. She knew it. The true sight, too, reached back into the past, and the watchers were somehow visible to the watched, if they knew how to look. If they were hungry to see.
So what should they do?
There would be those, she knew, who would want to shut down all of Past Watch to avoid the risk of contaminating the past with unpredictable and possibly devastating results in the present. And there would be others who would trust complacently in the paradoxes, believing that Past Watch could be seen by people of the past only under circumstances where it could not possibly affect the future. Fearful overreaction or smug negligence, neither was appropriate. She and Hassan had changed the past, and the change they introduced had in fact changed the present. Perhaps it had not changed all the intervening generations between then and now, but certainly it had changed Hassan and her. Neither of them would think, or do, or say anything that they would have thought or done or said without having heard the prayer of Putakam. They had changed the past, and the past had changed the future. It could be done. The paradoxes didn't stop it. The people of this golden time could do more than observe and record and remember. If that was so, then what of all the suffering that she had seen over all these years? Could there be some way to change it? And if it could be changed, how could she refuse? They had shaped her. It was superstition. It meant nothing. And yet she could not eat that evening, could not sleep that night, for thinking of their chanted prayer. Tagiri got up from her mat and checked the time. After midnight, and she could not sleep. Past Watch allowed its workers, wherever they dwelt, to live in the native manner, and the city of Juba had chosen to do so as much as possible. So she was lying on woven reeds in a loose-walled hut, cooled only by the wind. But there was a breeze tonight, and the hut was cool, so it wasn't heat that kept her awake. It was the prayer of the village of Ankuash. She pulled a robe over her head and went to the laboratory, where others also worked late. There were no set working hours for people who played so loosely with the flow of time. She told her true sight to show her Ankuash again, but after only a few seconds, she could not bear it and switched to another view. Columbus, landing on the coast of Hispaniola. The wrecking of the Santa Maria. The fort he built to hold the crew that he could not take back home with him. It was a miserable sight to see again. The way the crew attempted to make slaves of the nearby villagers, who simply ran away. The kidnapping of young girls. The gang rapes until the girls were dead. Then the Indies of several tribes began fighting back. This was not the ritual war to bring home victims for sacrifice. Nor was it the raiding war of the Caribs. It was a new kind of war. A punishing war. Or perhaps it was not so new, Tagiri realized. These oft-viewed scenes had been completely translated, and it appeared that the natives already had a name for a war of annihilation. They called it Star at White Man's Village War. The crew awoke one morning to find pieces of their sentries' bodies scattered through the fort, and 500 Indi soldiers in feathered splendor inside the stockade. Of course, they surrendered. The Indi villagers did not, however, adopt their captives preparatory to sacrifice. They had no intention of making these miserable rapists, thieves and murderers into gods before they died. There was no formula declaration of, "He is as my beloved son," when each Spanish sailor was taken into custody.
There would be no sacrifice, but there would still be blood and pain. Death, when it came, was a sweet relief. There were those, Tagiri knew, who relished this scene, for it was one of the few victories of the Indies over the Spanish, one of the first victories of a dark people over the arrogant whites. But she hadn't the stomach to watch it all the way through. She took no joy in torture and slaughter. Even when the victims of it were monstrous criminals who had tortured and slaughtered others. Tagiri understood too well that in the minds of the Spaniards, their victims had not been human. It is our nature, she thought, that when we intend to enjoy being cruel, we must transform our victim into either a beast or a god. The Spanish sailors made the Indies into animals in their minds. All that the Indies proved, with their bitter vengeance, was that they were capable of the identical transformation. Besides, there was nothing in this scene to tell her what she wanted to see. Instead, she sent the true sight to Columbus's cabin on the Niña, where he wrote his letter to the King of Aragon and the Queen of Castile. He spoke of vast wealth in gold and spices, rare woods, exotic beasts, vast new realms to be converted into Christian subjects, and plenty of slaves. Tagiri had seen this before, of course, if only to marvel at the irony that Columbus saw no contradiction between promising his sovereigns both slaves and Christian subjects out of the same populations. Now, though, Tagiri found something else to marvel at. She knew well enough that Columbus had seen no serious quantities of gold, beyond what might have been found in any Spanish village where the wealthiest household in town might have a few trinkets. He had understood almost nothing of what the Indies had said to him, though he convinced himself that he understood that they were telling him of gold farther inland. Inland. They were pointing west, across the Caribbean. But Columbus had no way of knowing that. He had seen no glimmer of the vast wealth of the Incas or the Mexica. Those were not to be seen by Europeans for more than 20 years, and when the gold at last began to flow, Columbus would be dead. Yet as she watched him writing, then spun back and watched him write again, she thought, he isn't lying. He knows the gold is there. He is so sure of it, even though he has never seen it and will never see it in his life. This is how he turned the eyes of Europe westward, Tagiri realized, by the force of his unshakable belief. If the King and Queen of Spain had made their decision solely on the basis of the evidence that Columbus brought back with him, there would have been no follow-up to Columbus's voyage. Where were the spices? Where was the gold? His first discoveries had not begun to repay even the costs of his own expedition. Who would throw good money after bad? Without real evidence, Columbus made these extravagant claims. He had found Sipangu. Cathay and the Spice Islands were close at hand. All false, or Columbus would have had a cargo to show for it. Yet anyone who looked at him, who heard him, who knew him, would recognize that this man was not lying, that he believed in his soul the things he said. On the strength of such a witness as this, new expeditions were financed, new fleets set sail. Great civilizations fell, and the gold and silver of a continent flowed eastward, while millions of people died of plagues, and the survivors watched helplessly as strangers came to rule their land forever. All because Columbus could not be doubted when he spoke of things he had not seen. Tagiri played the recording of the scene in Anguash, of the moment when Putukam told of her dream. She saw me and Hassan, thought Tagiri. And Columbus saw the gold. Somehow, He saw the gold, even though it lay decades in the future. We, with our machines, can see only into the past. But somehow, this Genovese man and this Indy woman saw what none can see. And they were right, even though there was no way, no sensible way, no logical way, they could be right. It was 4 in the morning when Tagiri came to the door of Hassan's wind-cooled hut. If she clapped her hands or called to him, it would waken others. So she slipped inside and found that he, too, was still awake. "You knew that I would come," she said.
"If I had dared," he answered, "I would have come to you."
"It can be done," she said, blurting it out at once. "We can change it. We can stop something. Something terrible. We can make it go away. We can reach back and make it better." He said nothing. He waited. "I know what you're thinking, Hassan. We might also make it worse."
"Do you think I haven't been going through this in my mind tonight?" said Hassan.
"Over and over. Look at the world around us, Tagiri. Humanity is finally at peace. There are no plagues. No children die hungry or live untaught. The world is healing. That was not inevitable. It might have ended up far worse.
What change could we possibly make in the past that would be worth the risk of creating a history without this resurrection of the world?"
"I'll tell you what change would be worth it," she said. "The world would not have needed resurrecting if it had never been killed."
"What? Do you imagine that there's some change we could make that would improve human nature? Undo the rivalry of nations? Teach people that sharing is better than greed?"
"Has human nature changed even now?" asked Tagiri.
"I think not. We still have as much greed, as much power lust, as much pride and anger as we ever had. The only difference now is that we know the consequences and we fear them. We control ourselves. We have become, at long last, civilized."
"So you think that we can civilize our ancestors?"
"I think," said Tagiri, "that if we can find some way to do it, some sure way to stop the world from tearing itself to pieces as it did, then we must do it. To reach into the past and prevent the disease is better than to take the patient at the point of death and slowly, slowly bring her back to health. To create a world in which the destroyers did not triumph."
"If I know you at all, Tagiri," said Hassan, "you would not have come here tonight if you didn't know already what the change must be."
"Columbus," she said. "One sailor? Caused the destruction of the world?"
"There was nothing inevitable about his westward voyage at the time he sailed. The Portuguese were on the verge of finding a route to the Orient. No one imagined an unknown continent. The wisest ones knew that the world was large, and believed that an ocean twice the width of the Pacific stretched between Spain and China. Not until they had a sailing vessel they believed was capable of crossing such an ocean would they sail west. Even if the Portuguese bumped into the coast of Brazil, there was no profit there. It was dry and sparsely populated, and they would have ignored it just the way they largely ignored Africa and didn't colonize it for 4 long centuries after exploring its coast."
"You've been studying," he said.
"I've been thinking," she said. "I studied all this years ago. It was because Columbus came to America with his relentless faith that he had found the Orient. Merely stumbling on the landmass meant nothing. The Norse did it, and where did that lead? Even a chance landing by someone else on Cuba or the eastern tip of Brazil would have meant no more than the meaningless landings on Vinland or the Guinea coast. It was only because of Columbus's reports of boundless wealth that never came true until after he was dead that other sailors followed him. Don't you see?
It was not the fact that somebody sailed west that led to the European conquest of America and thus of the world. It was because Columbus did it. One man, then, was responsible for the devastation of our planet?
Of course not, said Tagiri. I'm not talking about moral responsibility anyway. I'm talking about cause. Europe was already Europe. Columbus didn't make it that way. But it was the pillaging of America that financed the terrible religious and dynastic wars that swept Europe back and forth for generations. If Europe hadn't had possession of America, could it have imposed its culture on the world? Would a world dominated by Islam or ruled by Chinese bureaucracy have ever destroyed itself the way we did, in a world where every nation tried to become as European as it could? Of course it would, said Hassan. Europeans didn't invent pillage. No, they invented the machines that made their pillaging so madly efficient. The machines that sucked all the oil out of the ground and let us carry war and famine across oceans and continents until 9/10 of humankind was dead. So Columbus is responsible for the age of technology. Don't you see, Hassan, I'm not affixing blame? I know, Tagiri. I'm finding the place where the smallest, simplest change would save the world from the most suffering. That would cause the fewest cultures to be lost, the fewest people to be enslaved, the fewest species to fall extinct, the fewest resources to be exhausted. It comes together at the point where Columbus returns to Europe with his tales of gold and slaves and nations to be converted into Christian subjects of the king and queen.
So you would kill Columbus?
Tagiri shuddered. No, she said. Who is to say that we could ever travel physically into the past in such a way that that would even be possible? We don't need to kill him anyway. We only need to turn him away from his plan of sailing west. We have to find out what's possible before we decide how to do it. And murder? I could never agree to that. Columbus was no monster. We've all agreed to that ever since the Tempelview showed the truth of him. His vices were the vices of his time and culture, but his virtues transcended the milieu of his life. He was a great man. I have no wish to undo the life of a great man. Hassan nodded slowly. Let us say this. If we knew that we could turn Columbus away, and if, after much research, we were sure that stopping him would really stop the terrible course of the world from that time forward, then it might be worth undoing this age of healing on the firm chance of making it unnecessary. Yes, said Tagiri. It might be the work of lifetimes, finding the answers to those questions.
It might, said Tagiri.
But it might not. And even after we were very sure, we might be wrong, and the world might end up worse off than before.
With one difference, said Tagiri. If we stop Columbus, we can be sure of this. Putukam and Baiku would never die under Spanish swords.
I'm with you this far, said Hassan. Let's find out if it's possible and desirable to do this thing. Let's find out if the people of our own time agree that it's worth it, that it's right to do it. And if they agree that it is, then I'll be with you when it's done.
His words were so confident, yet she felt a dizzying vertigo, as if she stood on the edge of a great chasm, and the ground had just shifted a little under her feet. What sort of arrogance did she have, even to imagine reaching back into the past and making changes? Who am I, she thought, if I dare to answer prayers intended for the gods? Yet she knew, even as she doubted herself, that she had already made up her mind.
The Europeans had had their future, had fulfilled their most potent dreams, and it was their future that now was the dark past of her world, the consequences of their choices that now were being scoured from the earth. European dreams led to this, to a deeply wounded world in convalescence, with 1,000 years of physicking ahead, with so much irretrievably lost to be recovered only on the holotapes of past watch. So if it is in my power to undream their dreams, to give the future to another people, who is to say that it's wrong? How could it be worse? Christopher Columbus, Cristóbal Colón, as the Spanish called him, Cristóforo Colombo, as he was baptized in Genova. He would not discover America after all, if she could find a way to stop him. The prayer of the village of Anquash would be answered. And by answering that prayer, her own thirst would be slaked. She could never satisfy the hopeless longing in the faces of all slaves in all times. She could never wipe away the sadness in the face of her ancient great-grandmother Dico and her once joyous little boy, Acho. She could never give their lives and bodies back to the slaves. But she could do this one thing, and by doing it, the burden that had been building up inside her all these years would finally be lifted. She would know that she had done all that was possible to heal the past. The next morning, Tagiri and Hassan reported what had happened. For weeks, the most important leaders of Past Watch, and many leaders from outside Past Watch too, came to them to see the holotape, to discuss what it might mean. They listened to Tagiri and Hassan as they raised their questions and proposed their plans. In the end, they gave consent for a new project to explore what Putakam's vision might mean. They called it the Columbus Project, as much because it seemed the same kind of mad, impossible journey that Columbus had embarked on in 1492, as because the project might lead to undoing his great achievement. Tagiri kept the slavery project going, of course, but with Hassan, she now launched the new project with a very different team of workers. Hassan led the group that studied history to see if stopping Columbus would have the effect that they desired, and to discover if some other change might be more desirable or more easily practicable. Tagiri divided her working hours between the slavery project and coordinating the work of 12 physicists and engineers who were trying to find out exactly how it was that temporal backwash might work and how to alter the time machines in order to enhance the effect enough to allow the alteration of the past. Early on in their collaboration, Tagiri and Hassan married and had a daughter and a son. The daughter they named Dico, and Acho was the boy. Both children grew strong and wise, immersed in their parents' love and in the Columbus Project from their infancy. Acho grew up to be a pilot, skimming over the surface of the earth like a bird, fast and free. Dico did not stray so far from home. She learned the languages, the tools, the stories inherent in her parents' work, and spent her days beside them. Tagiri looked at her husband, her children, and more than once she thought, what if some stranger from a faraway place came and stole my son from me and made a slave of him, and I never saw him again? What if a conquering army from a place unheard of came and murdered my husband and raped my daughter? And what if, in some other place, happy people watched us as it happened and did nothing to help us, for fear it might endanger their own happiness? What would I think of them? What kind of people would they be?
3. Ambition. Sometimes Deko felt as if she had grown up with Christopher Columbus, that he was her uncle, her grandfather, her older brother. He was always present in her mother's work, scenes from his life playing out again and again in the background. One of her earliest memories was of Columbus giving orders for his men to capture several Indies to take back to Spain as slaves. Deko was so young she didn't realize the significance of what was happening, really. She knew, however, that the people in the Hall of View weren't real, so when her mother said with deep, bitter anger, "I will stop you," Deko thought that Mother was speaking to her, and she burst into tears. "No, no," said Mother, rocking her back and forth. "I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to the man in the Hall of View." "He can't hear you," said Deko. "He will someday."
"Papa says he died 100 years ago."
"Longer than that, my Deko."
"Why are you so mad at him? Is he bad?"
"He lived in a bad time," said Mother. "He was a great man in a bad time." Deko couldn't understand the moral subtleties of this. The only lesson she learned from the event was that somehow the people in the Hall of View were real after all, and the man called variously Cristoforo Colombo and Cristobal Colón and Christopher Columbus was very, very important to Mother. He became important to Deko, too. He was always in the back of her mind. She saw him playing as a child. She saw him arguing endlessly with priests in Spain. She saw him kneel before the King of Aragon and the Queen of Castile. She saw him trying vainly to talk to Indies in Latin, Genovese, Spanish, and Portuguese. She saw him visiting his son at a monastery in La Rábida. When she was 5, Deko asked her mother,
"Why doesn't his son live with him?"
"Who?"
"Cristoforo," said Deko. "Why does his little boy live at the monastery?"
"Because Colombo has no wife."
"I know," said Deko. "She died."
"So while he's struggling to try to get the king and queen to let him make a voyage west, his son has to stay somewhere safe, where he can get an education."
"But Cristoforo has another wife the whole time," said Deko.
"Not a wife," said Mother.
"They sleep together," said Deko.
"What have you been doing?" asked Mother. "Have you been running the Hall of View when I wasn't here?"
"You're always here, Mama," said Deko.
"That's not an answer, you sly child. What have you been watching?"
"Cristoforo has another little boy with his new wife," said Deko. "He never goes to live in the monastery."
"That's because Columbo isn't married to the new baby's mother."
"Why not?" asked Deko.
"Deko, you're 5 years old and I'm very busy. Is it such an emergency that I have to explain all this to you right now?" Deko knew that this meant she would have to ask Father. That was all right. Father wasn't home as much as Mother, but when he was, he answered all her questions and never made her wait till she grew up. Later that afternoon, Deko stood on a stool beside her mother, helping her crush the soft beans for the spicy paste that would be supper. As she stirred the mashed beans as neatly but vigorously as she could manage, another question occurred to her.
"If you died, Mama, would Papa send me to a monastery?"
"No," said Mother.
"Why not?"
"I'm not going to die, not till you're an old woman yourself."
"But if you did?"
"We're not Christians, and it's not the 15th century," said Mother. "We don't send our children to monasteries to be educated."
"He must have been very lonely," said Deko.
"Who?"
"Cristoforo's boy in the monastery."
"I'm sure you're right," said Mother.
"Was Cristoforo lonely too?" asked Deko, "without his little boy?"
"I suppose," said Mother. "Some people get very lonely without their children. Even when they're surrounded by other people all the time, they miss their little ones. Even when their little ones get older and turn into big ones, they miss the little ones that they'll never see again." Deko grinned at that.
"Do you miss the 2-year-old me?"
"Yes."
"Was I cute?"
"Actually, you were annoying," said Mother. "Always into everything, never at rest. You were an impossible child. Your father and I could hardly get anything done for looking after you."
"Wasn't that cute?" asked Deko. She was a little disappointed. "We kept you, didn't we?"